Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington, D.C. Fighting erupts in the Sudanese capital, Khartoum, Saturday.
People woke up this morning, early Saturday in Khartoum, on a gunfire. It started around 9 o'clock.
The U.S. and the Chinese ambassadors to Zambia say their two nations would put their differences aside to help the Southern African country address its debt.
First of all, we are very grateful that we've had a number of important visitors from the U.S. in Zambia. I'm sure from the other side also, since you talked about the Chinese and American ambassador, we shall certainly see also important visitors from that country.
And Nigeria's president-elect dismisses calls for a rerun of the recent presidential election.
We have never had a situation in which frontline presidential candidates who have lost elections have come out and said, I lost this election. So what we are saying is that we want to see the international media and international election observers come in and make their assessments on the basis of evidence-backed fact.
Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Fighting erupted in the Sudanese capital Khartoum this morning between the Sudan Armed Forces and the paramilitary group called Rapid Support Forces, or RSF. Sudan's General Intelligence Services described the RSF as rebels, while the leader of the RSF called Sudan's military leader, General Abdul Fattah al-Burhan, a thief and a liar. The RSF has taken control of the state broadcaster Sudan Television and a military base in the northern town of Marowi. For more, my colleague John Tanza spoke with VOA reporter in Khartoum for an update on the fighting in the capital.
People woke up this morning, early Saturday in Khartoum, on a gunfire. It started around 9 o'clock, where people could just hear gunfire erupted in the southern part of the Khartoum in Soba Sabab. And also it moves towards the towards the central market, where there was also a base of the Rapid Support Forces based at the Olympic Stadium. So the fighting actually erupted between the Sudan Armed Forces and the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces. It is unknown that who actually initiated the fighting, but at the end of the day, the fighting took place, and according to the statement issued by the Sudan's doctors, that at least three people have been so far killed and more than 10 others injured, as I speak.
What other towns are you hearing the news of fighting from? What other towns?
Similar incident have been reported from the far north town of Merowe, where Wednesday, Rapid Support Forces actually moved more than 110 troops there. And there are also reports of fighting, and each one of them is trying to control the military base and the Merowe airport as well.
How is the situation in Khartoum? We also understood that the Rapid Support Forces, some of them stormed Khartoum International Airport. We could see pictures of smoke coming out of the airport. What is the situation like?
The statement issued by the doctor said those two people actually were killed at the airport. And we are also seeing some footage on social media that the military headquarters of the RSF near the military headquarters in Khartoum has been bombed by the gunship. And several of them also been arrested and all this. So those videos are there on social media. But we are hearing similar reports also from the other parts of Darfur, in Niala, South Darfur, and also in El Geneina in Western Darfur, coming also to the Central Darfur in Zalenje.
Michael Atit is VOA's reporter in Sudan. He spoke with my colleague John Tanza from the Sudanese capital, Khartoum. In Malawi, former President Arthur Peter Mutharika has been endorsed by the Central Region Bloc of the main opposition Democratic Progressive Party, or DPP, to lead the group in the presidential contest in the coming 2025 elections. The announcement comes after the DPP North Bloc also endorsed the former president last week. Some chiefs and elders have also called on Mutharika to lead the party for the next election. The DPP is scheduled to soon organize its convention to choose representatives, including a presidential candidate, ahead of the polls. If chosen, the former president will challenge incumbent President Lazarus Chakwera, who will seek a second and final term. For reaction to the endorsement, I reached former Malawian President Arthur Peter Mutharika.
Yes, it is a big one. This follows the one in the north last week, which also made an endorsement. They're both big, and I'm certainly flattered by the confidence that the two blocks have shown in me and my leadership.
Mr. President, are you going to take them up on it and run for a second and final term?
Yes, as I've said, there have been requests from party members, civil society, chiefs, faith community, across sections of the community, that I need to come back and complete my second term, which, as you know, was terminated after 1 year. I'm thinking about it very, very seriously because running for president is very complicated, both physically and mentally. And I've done it three times now. When I did 2019, I thought that was my last one. And then there was a court notification, and I ran again 2020. So I've run three times for president, and I know what it's like. So I have taken this, advisedly, thinking about it very carefully, I expect to make an announcement before the convention in July. We hope to have the convention in July this year. So at some point before July, I'll certainly make an announcement one way or the other.
Well, Mr. President, what do you say to those who are of the view that you have served Malawi well? It's now time to be a kingmaker, to bless somebody to take over the mantle from you. You have run a good race. Sure. Now it's time to hand over to the younger generation. And then you ask as a father figure to guide them on how best to move the country forward. What do you say to those people?
No, I think they probably are right, under normal circumstances. That should be the case. But why this matter has come up, because, as you know, my election was nullified and very dubious circumstances in which all the international observers, African Union, European Union, Commonwealth, SADC, COMESA, they all say the election free, fair, transparent, and credible. And yet the court went ahead and nullified the election. As you know, the court itself said that they found that there was no rigging. They found that there are minor irregularities, which happen in every election, but that the irregularities do not affect the outcome of the election. And yet they went ahead and nullified the election. And I think this is really the problem that we have. That's why many lawyers, including members of Brisbane, have called this a judicial coup d'etat, probably the first one in the history of jurisprudence that this has happened. Certainly the first one in the history of Africa, but probably in the Commonwealth. So they that matter, and the people feel that all these projects that I started, that I need to complete, which I was not able to complete. So that's really what underlies this whole question.
So, Mr. President, what do you say to analysts who are of the view that you were the incumbent president and you lost to the opposition politician, in this case, Dr. Lazarus Chakwera, the current president? What makes you think that you will be able to defeat him now that he is the incumbent president with all the trappings of the government machinery behind him this time in 2025? How do you respond to them?
Well, actually, in all the previous elections, 2014, 2019, and 2020, the last election, one-on-one, I've defeated him all the time by over 5 percentage points. It's just that in 2020, he was joined by the current vice president and my former vice president, Mr. Chilima, who brought in 20% of the vote. And that 20% is actually 20% that came from the DPP, my own party. So, in fact, I had 40% of the vote. Chakwera had 35, and Chilima had 20. So combined, it made it 55 to 40. That's what happened. Without Chilima, Chakwera would not have won.
Arthur Peter Mutharika is a former president of Malawi. He spoke with me from the capital, Lilongwe.
Tell your friends about VOA Africa, music, sports, and news.
The U.S. and the Chinese ambassadors to Zambia say their two nations will put their differences aside to help the Southern African country address its $14 billion debt. Analysts say the debt in Zambia is unsustainable and it's making the country unattractive to local and foreign investors. Meanwhile, the government led by Finance Minister Situmbeko Musukotwani is in talks with the World Bank and IMF officials on restructuring the debt. Musukotwani is currently in Washington for talks with IMF and World Bank officials during the ongoing meetings in Washington. I sat down with the minister and asked him about Zambia's economic outlook and the prospects of the talks. Here is part one of the conversation with the Zambian finance minister.
The first expectation is that right now, priority number one for Zambia is to push for the issue of the debt relief for Zambia to be completed. That's priority number one. This is so because as long as the debt issue remains unresolved, uncertainties remain in the economy in terms of investment, in terms of people who participate in our local financial markets. So this is causing uncertainty, and we need to get the matter resolved. So in coming here, we are talking to executive directors of various countries, especially those with the biggest influence at the IMF and the World Bank, to plead with them. I know they've been assisting a lot, but to plead with them just to keep on pushing and get this matter resolved.
So currently, what would you say is the economic outlook in Zambia, looking at the debt situation? How challenging does it make the overhang of this debt issue?
The economy is doing reasonably well. For this year, 2023, we expect the growth to be just over 4%, which is not bad. Inflation is just under 10% from more than 20% sometime last year. But where we have challenges is the issue of jobs and youth unemployment. This is why we need to get this matter of debt to be resolved, because there are people waiting to get this matter resolved so that they can come and invest into our mining, into our agriculture, into manufacturing, tourism, and so forth. So we need the debt to be resolved so that we begin to make a mark on employment, especially for the youth.
Mr. Finance Minister, talking about the debt situation, recently in Lusaka, your capital, the U.S. ambassador and the Chinese ambassador made a statement about Zambia's $14 billion debt. What does this mean for Zambia and for these two countries to put saying they'll put aside their differences to help Lusaka, literally, to manage the debt situation? What does this mean for you?
First of all, we are very grateful that we've had a number of important visitors from the U.S. in Zambia. We had the Treasury Secretary coming to visit us, followed by now the Vice President of the U.S. Visiting us. I'm sure from the other side also, since you talked about the Chinese and American ambassador, we shall certainly see also important visitors from that country. The statement by the two ambassadors is very important because China is a creditor country to Zambia, okay? But also has been donating. The Chinese have made a lot of donations to Zambia. America similarly supports us a lot, especially in the area of health. It's no secret that without American support, HIV/AIDS would have wiped out bigger portions of the Zambian population. So when they come together and put issues of their issues aside and say, let's work together to get Zambia out of the debt crisis, we are extremely grateful for those. We are extremely grateful for that for that event. We encourage them to do more because we want to get out of this debt. But beyond that, both countries are capital exporting countries. In other words, they have the financial resources to invest outside their countries. And given the fact that we have climate change, for which everybody is saying, let's get to green energy. What is green energy? Green energy is copper products, it's nickel products, manganese products, stuff like that. We are saying to both of them, Zambia is open for business. Come and invest, do batteries, do green technology, and export. Similarly, in the issue of agriculture, right now there's a grain shortage because of the war in Ukraine. We are saying Zambia has a lot of empty space. We want to be an answer to the grain shortage of the world. How do we do that? Open up space, put infrastructure, roads, power, and then we go to investors, wherever they are, come and invest with us so that we become an answer to the issue of global food shortages.
Dr. Situmbeko Musokotwane is Zambia's finance minister. He spoke with me from here in Washington. Join us on Sunday for the conclusion of the conversation. In Uganda, the anti-corruption agency, the Inspectorate of Government, says it has implemented new measures in the fight against graft and malfeasance in the East African country. The agency also says it remains committed to a policy of zero tolerance of corruption. The remarks come after President Yoweri Museveni's latest call on citizens not to engage in corrupt practices and wrongdoing. This after Mary Goretti Kitutu, the Minister for Karamoja Affairs, and two others were charged with corruption and conspiracy to commit a felony. The minister is accused of diverting iron sheets meant for disaster victims supported by the Karamoja Community Empowerment Program. But critics say the government has yet to demonstrate its commitment in the fight to weed out graft, an accusation supporters sharply deny. For more on the fight against corruption, I reach Betty Kamia. She is the Inspector General of Government.
We have put in a new dimension, and that is the dimension of recruiting the entire population to join the war, because we want it to be a people-driven war rather than an elitist war fought by technocrats and civil society, donors, development partners, and government officials. That is very elitist. What is a people-driven war is when the people understand that they are the victims of corruption. Corruption hurts them because it undermines service delivery. So when people understand that corruption actually hurts them, that they are the victims of corruption, then people will join the war against corruption.
I was about to ask you how Ugandans are responding to your call for them to be part of this fight against corruption, to own it, basically, to speak.
Of course, it won't happen within the click of a moment. It's going to be a protracted people's war, because it takes a while for people to understand and for the message to run through the entire population. It does take a while. But I would say that the message so far is being received very well. People need to be equipped with information and basically what they need to do. What they're asking is, so what do you want us to do? And the message is, we want you to get involved and say no to corruption and report actions of corruption and be involved, especially in the lifestyle audit. Be your brother's keeper.
Some people have asked if there is a political will in that fight against corruption and whether your organization has what you need in order to be successful in this fight, whether you have the funding, whether you have the cooperation of the government and other stakeholders to ensure success.
First of all, the Constitution of Uganda makes the Office of the Inspectorate of Government independent of any authority or person. To that extent, we are an independent institution. But we also have the cooperation of government to the extent that, one, I have never received, for instance, a phone call or a threat or a letter or even a sign from anybody in the state telling me what to do or what not to do. That has not happened. I'm 2 years in the office now, and I've had a free reign. So I cannot say that there's no political will.
Now, so the president recently called for the prosecution of everybody or anybody who is engaged in acts of corruption. What comes into sharp focus is the recent Karamoja scandal.
Yes, the president called for the prosecution, but you know our judicial system, in a judicial system, one is innocent until proven guilty. And to be proven guilty, the court requires evidence beyond reasonable doubt. Now, to do that, you need to be very, very thorough. You need to have evidence beyond reasonable doubt to stand up in court. So some people may not, it's not always easy to get that kind of evidence, and that takes investigations a while, a long time. That's why many cases end up taking a long time, and people even get discouraged by the long investigations. But that is our judicial system. People are deemed innocent until proven guilty. Now, proving guilty is another story for another day. But yes, the president did say, please prosecute, arrest and prosecute all those people that were involved in the Iron Sheet scandal.
Betty Kamya is the Inspector General of Government. She spoke with me from the Ugandan capital, Kampala. In Nigeria, President-elect Asiwaju Bola Ahmed Tinubu
has dismissed as baseless calls for a rerun of the recent presidential election. Former Vice President Atiku Abubakar of the main opposition People's Democratic Party, PDP, and former Anambra State Governor Peter Obi of the Labour Party, or LP, are challenging the outcome of the presidential vote. The Independent National Electoral Commissioner, INEC, declared Tinubu as winner of the presidential contest, but citing voter irregularities, rigging, intimidation, and harassment, the two losing candidates have petitioned the court seeking to challenge Tinubu's victory. Ajuri Ngelale is a spokesperson for the president-elect's campaign team. In an interview with me, he says it is unfortunate that opposition groups use social media platforms to peddle what he calls fake news to citizens and the international community.
It is a symptom of the fact that we are a democracy in its infancy, that we have never had an election conducted in our nation in which you did not have opposition candidates suggesting or outright expressing that the election was flawed. We have never had a situation in which frontline presidential candidates who have lost elections have come out and said, "I lost this election." Some of that has to do with the fact that they're playing to their political bases. We've seen this in Africa for a long time now. So what we are saying is that we want to see the international media and international election observers come in and make their assessments on the basis of evidence-backed fact. And if that's done, we can acknowledge that there may be areas where we can certainly improve. But the general notion that we are not reflecting the will of our people, when we saw the President Muhammadu Buhari lose his state in the presidential election, when we saw the incoming president, President-elect Asiwaju Bola Ahmed Tinubu, lose his state, Lagos state, in the presidential election, if we were rigging elections, these instances would not be, they would not have happened. And that's where we are.
What do you say to those who are saying that there appear to be an orchestrated move to massage some figures in specific areas during the election, and that the issues and the measures the Electoral Commission or INEC implemented to ensure transparency and credibility of the elections were severely undermined with their refusal, so to speak, to upload the polling results from each polling stations using the mechanism, the beavers, they said, to ensure transparency? How do you respond to such critics?
This was a major element of the misinformation campaign that certain agents of the opposition campaigns. After the election is actually conducted on the ground, the results are signed off by the agents, the observing agents of the political parties. They have to agree that this is the result from this polling unit before it's now sent up to the various collation centers. The point here is that the argument that's being peddled in the international media, in some international media, is that because the IREF portal had a glitch, merely because we had an instantaneous and sudden and massive demand on one website. We saw this with Obamacare a few years ago. That was not because Barack Obama and the U.S. government at that time wanted to deny Americans health care. It was because there was a technological error, a glitch. We had the same thing happen. But what we are saying is that even with that glitch, it had no impact whatsoever on the actual conduct of the election. And I would liken it to somebody saying that because there was a problem with their television at home and they could not watch the Super Bowl, they're now saying because their TV didn't work that the Super Bowl was not played in the stadium. We believe that that's a foolish argument.
Well, let me ask you about the dispute and some of the evidence the opposition parties, the PDP and the Labour Party, claim they have to challenge the outcome of the presidential election result particularly. They said all kinds of things, including that the cash crunch was part of the system to rig the election, and that INEC chairman and some of the officials came up with figures that were totally different from what was read. How do you address these concerns?
Well, this is the beauty of our democracy and the beauty of our constitutional democratic setup in Nigeria is that we have a very clear set of legal mechanisms by which the opposition candidates can go through the judicial process to make their case. We have seen several instances in our nation in which governors have lost their seats, senators have lost their seats, many high-ranking officials have lost their seats because of electoral malpractice, because of the legal and judicial processes that have been, you know, put in place for dissatisfied, you know, political combatants. So we are very much convinced that we have a system that is tried and tested. We have seen several high-ranking officials lose their offices as a result of these tribunals and court judgments. And we have no doubt that if there was any instance whatsoever of the All Progressives Congress or any other party abusing the electoral procedures and processes on election day, that ultimately any wrongly elected candidate or falsely elected candidate will lose his office. We believe in the process, and we believe that the opposition must too.
Before we go, Ajuri, where do Nigerians go from here? Looking at how the elections went, the dispute before the court at the moment, where do Nigerians go from here? How do you create a system to ensure that they are satisfied with the outcome of elections in the future?
Well, we're certainly enthused by the fact that already we have seen all of the opposition candidates that are protesting the outcome of the election go to their respective courts to challenge the election. That is healthy. We embrace that as a ruling party. President Muhammadu Buhari embraces that. President-elect Bola Ahmed Tinubu embraces that. And we look forward to the conclusion of that process. But in the meantime, we recognize that the temperature in the country has gone up. And we also recognize that we have a responsibility as an incoming administration and as the governing party in the country, the All Progressives Congress, to bring the temperature down. And how we do that is by uniting all Nigerians, even those who supported the candidates who lost the election or the candidates who are contesting the election in court, that there is a need, an imminent need, to build our country across sectors.
Ajuri Ngelale is a spokesperson for Nigeria's president-elect campaign team. He spoke with me from here in the VOA studios in Washington. You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, hospitals in Cameroon are seeing an increase in cases of river blindness, a parasitic disease caused by bites from infected black flies. Hundreds of aid workers have been dispatched to remote riverside villages to encourage those infected to seek treatment. For VOA, Moki Edwin Kenzeka reports from Saar, Cameroon.
Bonjour,
Papa.
Bonjour.
Comment tu vas?
Ça va un peu.
A health worker greets two men and a woman in front of their family home in Saar district, 74 kilometers north of Cameroon's capital, Yaoundé. The eldest among the three is 45-year-old Jean-Christophe Onana. Onana says he has not been able to recover his sight after receiving treatment from an African traditional healer for 2 months. He says he strongly believes that he has been bewitched by his enemies, who are envious of last year's abundant yield from his cocoa farm. Aid workers say Onana suffers from river blindness, a parasitic disease particularly prevalent in Africa, where 99% of all cases occur. Cameroon's Ministry of Public Health says that hospitals in Lekie, the administrative unit where Saar is located, have reported several hundred fresh cases of river blindness within the past 3 months. The Central African States government says the increase is in areas where there have been floods and where new farmland was opened near rivers, attracting settlers. Ophthalmologist Raoul Edgar Chetu is one of the aid workers in Saar.
Nous avons décidé de commun accord avec les autorités compétentes.
He says humanitarian agencies and the governments of Cameroon have decided to jointly equip the Saar District Hospital and scores of other hospitals in areas where there is an increase in river blindness cases with standard tests for the diagnosis of the disease. Churchill says onchocerciasis is increasing in SAR because of its many rivers that are breeding sites for black flies that transmit river blindness. Aid workers are educating civilians in Cameroon riverside villages that river blindness is not a spell or divine punishment for wrongdoing, but an infection that can be controlled and treated at hospitals. Cameroon reports that youths are deserting remote villages where the number of people suffering from the parasitic disease of the skin and eyes transmitted by the black fly is increasing. The Cameroon government says besides SAR, several hundred hospitals in Cameroon's center, east and south regions have reported at least 6,000 new infections within 3 months. The figures may be higher since 70% of Cameroonians go for African traditional medicine where it is difficult to collect data, the government says. The Global Institute for Disease Elimination, GLIDE, works with the Cameroon Ministry of Public Health to help accelerate treatments for river blindness, a neglected tropical disease. GLIDE's top official, Dr. Asaitu Daiwara, says river blindness is a public health concern in Cameroon because about 6 million of the country's 26 million inhabitants are already infected. She spoke by a messaging app.
Despite 2 decades of annual treatment with community-directed treatment with ivermectin or CDTI, confirmed cases of onchocerciasis are still present in 113 health districts previously classified as hyperendemic. So the use of test and treat strategy and addressing community levels barriers to treatment are essential steps towards eliminating onchocerciasis in Cameroon.
Diawara says black flies that transmit river blindness breed along fast-flowing rivers and streams close to remote villages located near fertile land where people rely on agriculture. She said river blindness is transmitted to humans through exposure to repeated bites of infected black flies, and symptoms include severe itching, disfiguring skin conditions, and visual impairment, including permanent blindness. The United Nations says onchocerciasis occurs mainly in tropical areas, with more than 99% of infected people living in 31 countries in sub-Saharan Africa, including Angola, Benin, Burkina Faso, Burundi, Cameroon, the Central African Republic, Chad, the Republic of Congo, Côte d'Ivoire, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Equatorial Guinea and Ethiopia, Gabon, Ghana, Guinea, Guinea-Bissau, Kenya, Liberia, Malawi, Mali, Mozambique, Niger, Nigeria, Rwanda, Senegal, Sierra Leone, South Sudan, Sudan, Togo and Tanzania suffer from river blindness, the UN reports. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, SAR, Cameroon.
The FinTech Africa Summit ended this week in Washington, and African tech entrepreneurs looking to grow their ideas and businesses on the continent are running into difficulties due to local regulations and lack of community trust for digital and non-tangible financial technology. For VOA, Anthony Labruto has more from Washington.
So we have a beautiful event. Thank you.
The future is limitless for technology entrepreneurs. For many, growing their businesses and securing funding are the top priority. For Baluka Mutinda, CEO of Dukapak, an online sales system, local regulation hampers his efforts to expand beyond the cities he's already based in.
But you notice that each market is very different. Even down to Nairobi, you can have neighborhoods that are very, very different from each other based on income, based on just the proximity or the location of the city. So just really having to figure out how we can build a product that can sustain itself beyond that fragmentation has been a challenge.
Oluwambankole Falade is the chief regulatory officer at Flutterwave. He said the lack of unified international regulation surrounding digital currency and payments leaves many of his potential customers uneasy about using his service.
Payments was fragmented, you know, from country to country, and even within countries, interoperability was a problem.
Still, Faladay believes he can alleviate some of this anxiety by investing in more digital infrastructure. By getting as many tangible financial institutions on board, Faladay believes Flutterwave will be the step towards community digital integration.
Interconnect with as many partners as possible, you know, be it from schemes to banks. So what we offer today through our single API integration for our merchants is merchants can focus solely on their business core competence and not worry about how to collect payments.
Other entrepreneurs are focusing their efforts solely on building trust and familiarity for their digital products by associating it with something well known. Christian Duffus, CEO of Fondbank, ties his digital payment currency system to prepaid phone minutes to take some of the uncertainty away from financial tech.
You know, one of the challenges with digital money, even cryptocurrencies, is in many respects, it's a closed ecosystem for the consumers, right? They can't, you know, buy food with it, pay rent with it, can't consume it directly in any way like they can cash. So where we're unique is that we use a unit of prepaid airtime, right? And we've tokenized this on a public blockchain. And as a result, people can consume prepaid airtime. There's 8 billion prepaid mobile SIMs globally. If you can have that type of broad availability, accessibility for consumers, with something they're familiar with, then that's how you address sort of the trust factor.
Even with the regulatory issues firms are facing, the African fintech industry is expected to reach $230 billion in revenue by 2025. Anthony Labruto for VOA News, Washington.
Direct from Washington, the voice of America, VOA.
U.S. Ambassador to Libya, Richard Norland, said the U.S. rejects any electoral process that leads to instability in Libya. Norland stressed the necessity of resolving the existing controversy regarding the identity of the candidates for the presidential elections, given that it was the reason for postponing the last elections, calling on the Libyans to resolve their position regarding the candidates for the elections. Rhiannon Smith, managing editor of the London-based Libya Analysis, explained this U.S. position and what it takes for elections to happen in Libya with U.S. senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi.
The U.S. and Richard Norland in particular has been putting a lot of effort and a lot of pressure in the last few weeks on the Libyan actors to try and get a electoral process in place so that elections can happen at the end of 2023. And I think this is a continuation of trying to maintain that pressure. What's happening now is there's an electoral committee, a committee to draft the election laws between the High Council of State and the House of Representatives. Now, the reason he's commenting on the presidential candidacies, that's the main outstanding issue that these two sides disagree on. And it's kind of what derailed the elections 2 years ago. Now, the one side, mainly in the west of Libya, they don't want to see the commander of the Libyan National Army, Khalifa Haftar. They don't want him to become president. And they therefore want to ensure that presidential candidates can't have dual nationality, because Haftar actually has American nationality, and to prevent serving military personnel from standing, which would basically eliminate him. The other side, the HOR, who are aligned with Haftar and in the east of the country, would like to see him in a position to take that presidential position. And this has been the main issue of disagreement. And that's what they are currently trying to find an agreement on. And hence this kind of international pressure that they can't get stuck on that issue again. They have to find a compromise and a way forward. We're right at the start of that process in the current committee. So it'll be interesting to see if anything happens. But it's certainly going to prove difficult, I think, unless they can agree a compromise.
Abdullah Batili, UN envoy to Libya, Libyan National Army's commander Khalifa Haftar, and the House of Representatives Speaker Aqila Saleh encouraged the holding of elections. Batili said, "To achieve peace and stability, we agreed not to spare any effort to promote hope and reconciliation among Libyans, including the leaders of the Joint Military Committee and commanders of military and security units from across Libya." Is that feasible?
It is going to be difficult, I think, still to hold elections by the end of 2023, because all of these issues that have plagued the previous attempts at elections remain, mainly that there's a lot of division in the country, but also that the status quo political actors like the HOR, like the government and others don't really want to have elections because that will mean they lose their positions. However, something that's happened this time that didn't happen 2 years ago is progress on the security front. And this is quite significant. So we've seen meetings between the Eastern LNA and Khalifa Haftar and other security actors in Western and Southern Libya, both in Tripoli and this week in Benghazi. And given, you know, just 4 years ago, there was full-on conflict in Tripoli between these two sets of different actors. This is quite a significant move forward. And if they're able to kind of continue with some of the reconciliation on the security side, it increases the chances of elections being able to happen because it will allow, you know, voting to take place in different places and less likelihood that the security actors will attempt to kind of spoil the elections. That said, we're still a long way to go. And obviously all of these security actors, the militias have their own interests and there's lots of kind of human rights abuses they're involved in and lots of concerns. But overall, I think it is a positive step which could help the whole process.
Libyan Prime Minister Abdelhamid Dbeiba said at the cabinet meeting that he continues to serve the Libyans and create conditions for fair and impartial elections, expressing his hope for the elections to succeed and its results to be accepted by all. What would it take for that to happen?
So we already mentioned that the security element, and I think that is an important one to have free and fair elections. The voters need, in theory, to be able, you know, not, they shouldn't be intimidated, and for candidates, you know, a variety of candidates to be able to stand. Now, I don't think we'll be able to have, you know, no violence or no intimidation at all, but certainly the kind of ongoing security talks help with that. The civil society for free and fair elections is very important. This is a bit worrying, and there's been a lot of recent developments, actually led, ironically, by Dubai, but kind of trying to crack down on some civil society organisations, and I think that could be quite concerning for elections. But I would say that the biggest thing for elections to take place and the results to be accepted is for the current political actors, the Dubai included, and the House of Representatives, the High State Council, they need to be willing to hand over their positions of power. In the past, that's what has stopped elections from happening or has led to the election results being contested. I think that's only really going to happen if the kind of international pressure from the UN, from the US, from others is maintained and that they are kind of forced really to hand over power. If not, I think we could unfortunately see a situation like in the past where elections occur, but you know, some parties reject it and we end up with two governments again.
Rhiannon Smith is managing editor of the London-based Libya Analysis. She spoke with viewers Mohammed El Shenawi from London. Right now it's time for music from our African collection.
name is Divine Tembeng Mba from Pretoria in South Africa, and you are listening to Nightline Africa from the Voice of America with Peter Clothe. Stay tuned and don't change that dial.
So you don't fear to fall in love, but I go fight till the day I go call you mine. Ah, all day, menkumi, baby, in sweetie, in jolly, menkumi, lady. Ah, oh my baby, you're a queen. Compliment me as a king. Get the boy and swamu go don, baby, bra, befin my mom. Grab a fin my nose.
That was music from the continent, and we hope you enjoy it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, including producer Mike Hovey, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, when you carry an elephant on your head, you won't notice that a rat is scratching your toes. I'm your host, Peter Clothe, in Washington, D.C. Good evening, Africa.